loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the West Virginia teacher strike entered a surprise seventh day today after the state Senate president hinted that he would not agree to a 5% pay raise proposed by the governor. Moreover, the tentative deal between the governor and the union would not address the underfunding of the Public Employees Insurance Agency. The teachers' union had expected a five-day strike, but the rank and file insisted on keeping up the fight. Next, bitter Brexit negotiations continue between the government of Prime Minister Theresa May and the European Union. At issue are key economic policies and the future of Northern Ireland, and the fragile May government is desperate for a breakthrough. Then, the annual meeting of the Hardline American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is this weekend in Washington, D.C., and it features senior politicians from both parties. Unpopular in his own country and in hot water in the court system there, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu will also speak. AIPAC is a powerful lobbying group that drives U.S. support for the settler project in Israel, U.S. weapons sales to Israel, and billions of dollars that this country sends them annually. This weekend, there are two rallies planned at the site of the convention. And then Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, is in big trouble. Reports suggest he's been meeting with the leaders of foreign countries not to further U.S. foreign policy goals, but to ask them for loans to prop up his family's failing real estate business. And the governments of China, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Mexico have all secretly talked about how to exploit Kushner's weaknesses. And finally, again this week, we look at the worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we look at the West Virginia teacher strike. The West Virginia teacher strike entered a surprise seventh day today after the state Senate president hinted that he would not agree to a 5% pay raise proposed by the governor. Moreover, the tentative deal between the governor and the union would not address the underfunding of the Public Employees Insurance Agency. The teachers' union had expected a five-day strike, but the rank and file insisted on keeping up the fight. We're joined from Morgantown, West Virginia, by community organizer Frank Arriott. Frank, welcome back.
Thank you.
Frank, this is really starting to get some national play. The teachers are unified, and they're on strike in every one of West Virginia's 55 counties. It looks like the turmoil is between the governor and the state legislature. What's happening over there?
Well, it comes down to that Jim Justice, the governor here, keeps going back and forth and giving different numbers as far as the state of the economy here in West Virginia. So as you mentioned, the Senate Majority Leader for West Virginia, his issue was that at the State of the State address, Jim Justice had stated that all that could be given to the teachers was 1%. That's all that could be afforded. But now Jim Justice is saying that he found enough money for 5%. For a 5% increase. And on top of that, Jim Justice has also stated that there's a $100 million surplus and that he's brought West Virginia out of a $500 million deficit. So there's kind of a lot of misleading information all the way around, within the Republican Party in the state.
Yeah, you know, the press is saying that the 5% pay raise would cost the state $58 million. As you said, Governor Justice says they have the money. Senator Carmichael, the Senate Majority Leader, says they don't have the money. But on top of that $58 million, the state's going to come out to the good $100 million because of the federal tax reform bill that passed into law a few weeks ago. So it looks, at least on paper, like the money is there. It's just that the teachers aren't getting it, at least not right now.
Correct. And the issue is that the money's been allocated into different areas, including extraction business, so natural gas, coal, that's what West Virginia gets is famous for. But the Republican Party and Jim Justice himself is refusing to pull that money out of those industries and give a portion of that to the teachers, as well as money going to different business interests within the state that's not related to extraction.
We're speaking with Frank Arriott, a community organizer from Morgantown, West Virginia, about the West Virginia teacher strike. Frank, I need for you to explain something to me. This is something I read twice today. I just don't understand it. The teachers union authorized a 5-day strike. They were specific that the strike was only supposed to last 5 days. Today is day 7, so technically this is a wildcat strike that does not necessarily have the support of the union's leadership. Is that true? Is the leadership going to stand by its rank and file, by its members?
As of right now, the leadership has to be beside the rank and file membership. You know, I have it on good source from within the union. For safety reasons, I'm not going to state his name, but I have it on good source that the union leadership is still negotiating with the state and with the governor. They're still with the strikers. When the continuation was announced, yes, it was a wildcat. And even though it's, you know, these extra days have not really been authorized by the union, it's still, you know, of course, the union leadership is going to stand by its members.
Well, another thing that the state, I think, is going to have to worry about is the possibility of teachers leaving West Virginia and going to neighboring states, whether Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio. Those are all states that are actively looking to hire teachers. They actually pay more than what the West Virginia teachers are making. And I think the union and the state governmental leadership are worried about a brain drain like we've seen in Kansas, where Governor Brownback of Kansas has so slashed the education budget that teachers are moving to Missouri to teach just because it's a better living there.
And unfortunately, you know, a separate issue, there has been a brain drain in West Virginia because of the government here is trying to hold on desperately to the dying coal industry, and it's not really trying to promote anything else that would really help people in the state. You know, the biggest private employer in the state is actually Walmart now. It's not the coal industry. So many people are from the state, graduate from its universities, and then leave. You know, I have a friend of mine that's a teacher here in Charleston, and she actually studied to be a teacher in D.C., but finished her degree back in West Virginia because she wanted to help her state. And now she's faced with the dilemma of what should she do? Should she stay in West Virginia or should she leave? You know, so this strike, how it gets resolved and if it gets resolved, is what's going to really determine what's going to happen. Are the teachers leaving? Is the brain drain going to continue, or is there going to be an actual effort to keep people in the state?
Frank, let's talk about the sentiment and the mood both amongst the teachers who are now wildcatting and amongst in the community, among parents, among students. Especially in a school strike, all of those things matter a great deal in terms of the morale of the strike, especially when you're wildcatting. You've gone on for 7 days. That's hard. It's hard to strike. Also, what's the position of the rest of labor inside of West Virginia? Go ahead.
Well, to start, you know, with the parents and the students, today, actually, in the Capitol, there was a solidarity protest with the students. Students actually came out in support of their teachers, as did their parents. Of course, that's not across the board. You have some parents that feel that the teachers are being quote-unquote ridiculous, as Jim Justice has stated, that they should be back in the classroom, that their children need to be somewhere while they're at work. And that's understandable, but you know, the teachers' responses will then come out and support us so we can resolve this issue. As far as the rest of labor, most of the people that I've spoken to on the ground, in different industries, especially fast food workers, they're entirely with the teachers and the service personnel. You know, they say, yes, they definitely should keep fighting. I mean, each of these people have a certain teacher in mind from their childhood that they think about as, you know, so it actually hits home to them. You know, teachers in the state become like family.
Frank, we have 2 minutes left. I want to ask you one final question, and that's about the second issue besides pay and the 5% pay increase. And that's the issue of the Public Employee Insurance Agency. This is the governmental entity that that provides health insurance to West Virginia's teachers. Premiums keep going up. Medical care costs more and more and more. And the teachers say that unless costs are reined in, they are just not going back to work. Tell us what's going on there and what the governor is going to do about health care.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole thing that started the wildcat action was the fact that PEIA was not addressed. As of right now, the governor, because he passed everything into the Senate, PEIA right now is in the hands of the state legislature, in the hands of the Senate and the House of Delegates. And now they're wanting to put that 5% pay raise towards the insurance program instead of putting it into the pockets of the teachers. So they're again trying to give this ultimatum of one or the other, right? Which, of course, is not the demands of those who are on strike. The demands are pay raise and a fully funded insurance program. You know, so this is the state of that, I guess, of that demand right now. It's kind of just up in the air in the Senate. It's been, you know, it's been tabled for now until they figure out, are they going to have a task force? Are they going to discuss severance tax? Nothing has been really put forward yet.
Yeah, Governor Justice said yesterday that he would set up a task force to stabilize PEIA costs, but the state legislature has not said anything about stepping in to try to rein in insurance costs. Well, we'll wrap it up there. We were joined from Morgantown, West Virginia by community organizer Frank Arriott. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Bitter Brexit negotiations continue between the government of Prime Minister Theresa May and the European Union. At issue are key economic policies and the future of Northern Ireland, and the fragile May government is desperate for a breakthrough. We're joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. George, it's always great to have you on the show.
Great to be with you guys.
So this is actually quite complicated. There are several different issues at play here. The hard border, soft border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, customs union, British membership in EU organizations. Tell us exactly what it is that Theresa May feels that she needs to accomplish now.
Well, as Henry Kissinger might put it, it's a pity they both can't lose. The European Union is widely reviled by left-wing people throughout the European Union's 350 million population and 28 countries for now. And the Theresa May government is probably reviled by almost as many, proportionately speaking. So watching the two of them go hammer and tongs, it's a little difficult to muster any sympathy for either. The material facts are these. The British people voted, 17.4 million people voted, that Britain must leave the EU. This despite the phalanx of experts from the ruling elite in Britain telling us all that it would be the equivalent of driving off a cliff. Big capital, finance capital in particular, very important in the British economy nowadays, is in a paroxysm of terror at the prospect of Britain leaving the EU. But what remains of Britain's industrial capital was also strongly against leaving. The deep state, strongly against leaving. All the political parties, strongly against leaving. The entire establishment moved heaven and earth to persuade the British not to vote leave. But vote leave they did. And there will be a very serious crisis in British democracy if the elite managers, by hook or by crook, and Tony Blair, one of the biggest crooks, has just predicted this day that there's now a 50% chance that Brexit will be wrecked. And if Tony Blair's on your side, you better take a good look at whether you're on the correct side. On the other hand, the Theresa May government lost its parliamentary majority of its own volition by volunteering for an election that didn't need to be held for four more years, thinking that it would wipe out what they thought was the widely unpopular left-wing leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. And the rest is history. So the Theresa May government is entirely like a cork tossing on the ocean, not in control of its own destiny. It's prey to ambush from either the conservative zealots for Brexit or, more deadly, perhaps, the moderate conservatives who know that the ruling class is firmly against leaving and who might change sides, swap sides, cross the floor, across the aisle, you might say, in the United States, and bring the government down. Though that would require a group of turkeys to vote for an early Christmas.
Yeah. And George, let's talk about the issue of Ireland and the border. And also, as you mentioned, the Tories, Theresa May's party is a minority coalition, a minority government at this point, relying on the DUP in Ireland, Northern Ireland, very, very, very right-wing party, and very pro-British and anti-Irish nationalism. What's going on with the border issue, and is it possible that Theresa May will lose her partner over this?
Well, of course, if she moves one way, she loses that partner. If she doesn't lose, if she doesn't move a different way, she loses others. It's a nightmarish situation that she is in. I'll put my cards on the table, lads. I wouldn't cross the road to save the grotesque six-county statelet of the north of Ireland. So the idea that we should bend British policy to protect and preserve the existence of something that should never have existed in the first place and represents not just a sectarian fiefdom, of the kind of anti-Catholic reaction that you alluded to, but is effectively now holding the balance of power in the British Parliament, a parliament in Britain that I don't believe it should even be a part of. The problem, though, is that none of the Irish parties are seizing the opportunity here, which is blatantly obvious to anyone with eyes, to say, well, if the majority in the north of Ireland want to remain in the EU, the best way to do that is to erase the border and reunify the island of Ireland and make Ireland what it should have been all along, an independent 32-county sovereign republic. None of the Irish parties are doing that. The mainstream Irish parties, which are really two cheeks of the same backside, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they don't have the courage to seize the day. So there are some people on my side of this argument that are now endlessly fixating on a soft border, hard border, where will the border be, and so on. But I don't believe in the border. Nothing that I decide to say or do will be influenced in any way by the exigencies of maintaining this abnormal, grotesque state that they call Northern Ireland.
We're listening to George Galloway. He's joining us from London. George is a legendary anti-war activist, former British parliamentarian. He also has a TV show, Sputnik, on RT. George Galloway, we have about just under 4 minutes left. Let's talk about Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party, and the speech that Jeremy made earlier regarding a position, a more refined position now, regarding a post-Brexit, a customs union arrangement between Britain, possibly, and the other EU countries.
Well, it was a refining of Labour's position, but to no material effect. It didn't really change anything very much. Having said that, I was against it, am against it, because the main effect if Jeremy managed to negotiate a new customs union, tailor-made, bespoke, as we say, between Brexit Britain and the remaining EU, it would force us to accept EU trade policy, in which we would have no hand, of course, because we'd be out of the EU. And that would, to give you just one example, which might be pertinent, would mean we'd still have to apply sanctions against Russia. So a Corbyn government could not unilaterally say we're going to trade with Russia normally, because the EU's trade policy would prevail. And their courts, the European Court of Justice, would prevail in any dispute over that. And it's very difficult to stay in a customs union if you're not in the single market. And if you're in the single market, there's not much point in saying you've left the EU, because you'd have to accept the neoliberal economic strictures of the EU to remain in that alignment. So I don't believe that Jeremy, whom I very much hope will be the next British Prime Minister, would in any case be able to achieve such a new customs union as he adumbrated in that speech. But it has turned the tables and made with the media and the ruling elite, who are now for the first time hailing Jeremy Corbyn. The CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, representing industrial capital, has now fully aligned itself with Jeremy Corbyn. It's a funny old world, really.
It is indeed. George, a customs union, really, because it allows for and retains the free movement of people and capital, it's not just like Brexit light, it's almost like EU light, except what you're saying is that it's actually not tenable.
It isn't, because the EU in the end could never accept it, and the British people who voted for Brexit will not accept free movement. Free movement sounds good to liberals, Brian, but it's not good to the working class in this small island, because it's a measure by which, or a means by which, wages are driven down and pressure is put on public services already devastated by austerity, and it drives rents up too, because the more people you have with a finite housing stock, the higher the rents go. So the places that voted for Brexit, well, your equivalent of the Rust Belt. It was your Pennsylvanias, your Michigans, and Ohio's and so on, places that are post-industrial, as they call them, meaning, of course, that the blue-collar workers who worked there and made real things are now either tossing hamburgers, if they're lucky, or sitting at home whilst their wives and children go out to work in 0 hours contracts, very low-paid and dead-end work.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London by legendary anti-war activist, former British parliamentarian George Galloway. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The annual meeting of the Hardline American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is this weekend in Washington, D.C., and it features senior politicians from both the Democratic and Republican parties. Unpopular in his own country and in hot water in the courts there, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will also speak. AIPAC is a powerful lobbying group that drives U.S. support for the settler project in Israel, U.S. weapons sales to Israel, and billions of dollars that we send that country annually. This weekend, there are two rallies planned at the site of the convention. We're joined from Florida by Ty Berry, an anti-war activist and international solidarity organizer. Ty, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about AIPAC. You know, it's such a huge organization. It's very, very well funded. It's very powerful on Capitol Hill and in the halls of the White House. But most Americans don't really know anything about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, we at Code Pink have been protesting outside AIPAC at the Washington Convention Center since 2006. I'll just tell you, they're very powerful. They claim to have every congressperson in Congress attending their events, which is outright lie. They tend to not tell the truths or lies many times. In the beginning, Congress people used to come in the front door and they weren't afraid. They're starting to get afraid. They're going into secret ways in. They're very much less attended now by our congressional representatives. Although since Beebe has been in charge here, it's become very, very, very right wing Republican type event. Less and less Democrats. But I can also say that attending so many of these AIPAC protests over the years, we used to be able to get inside. Now it's virtually impossible. They have such a security apparatus. I've never seen anything like it. And the other thing that's interesting about AIPAC conventions are they're extremely violent. These people always claim they want to talk to you. They always claim that we're wrong. We don't know what we're talking about. As soon as you start talking to them, they're in your face. They want to punch you. They've punched my partner, Medina Benjamin, twice now over the years. And then they run inside and hide, and they get protected by DC off-duty police, who are the new security apparatus outside of the convention center. One reason this year that we're protesting AIPAC is because AIPAC and the Israeli government is calling for a complete ban on our ability to use BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. They want to make laws in certain cities and certain states and federally, thank you, Ben Cardin of Maryland, that outlaws that makes it a criminal offense to use an American tradition of boycotting something that you don't like with your own money, your own words, denying our ability to have First Amendment rights to freedom of speech. That is how powerful AIPAC is.
Yeah, let's talk about BDS for a minute. Brian, we've talked about this on the show a couple of times. It just screams unconstitutional to me.
You mean to suppress BDS?
To suppress BDS, to suppress freedom of speech. I don't know how something like this can be constitutional and legal. But as Ty points out, members of Congress in both the House and the Senate and members of both parties are just lining up to support this terrible bill.
We have to put it in a little bit of historic context, too. When Martin Luther King and the Black Civil Rights Movement in the South, a minority population, were trying to win justice, they used the power of the purse, the power of the boycott, to try to both hurt businesses that segregated, that enforced apartheid, and to allow allies around the country to do things that would be meaningfully helpful for the movement, the beleaguered, besieged civil rights movement in the South. So there were boycotts, and the boycotts were prosecuted as conspiracy to harm business. And now we have, after the South African apartheid boycott movement in the 1980s that helped bring down South African apartheid, pro-Palestinian activists and people who believe in justice started the BDS, Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions. Same as the civil rights movement, same as the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Don't do business with apartheid. Don't do business with Israel. Don't buy their products. Make them pay through the pocketbook. In other words, a peaceful movement trying to use economic means to pressure the Israeli government. And as a consequence, those people are now being criminally targeted with new laws that impose civil and, in some cases, criminal penalties if you just advocate using First Amendment rights, the boycott tool. Go ahead, Ty.
Yeah, you know, 20 groups have been targeted by the Israeli government and with the help of our government. Remember, everything Israel does is always being helped by the U.S. government. We can't go to one of our senators or representatives and say, hey, look, we're being targeted by the Israeli government. Me and Medea both went to, and others, went to Palestine or Israel occupied 48 Palestine. We went there to test the ban. We've been banned from Israel. And we were allowed in. I mean, it was like less security than there is at the convention center. We were just given a stamp and walked in. But the point of it is that if I want to have my constitutional right to visit a country such as Palestine, I'm blocked by the occupying country of Israel because I have to use an Israeli port of entry to get into Palestine. They blocked the Appleby Bridge coming from Jordan. You have to fly into Tel Aviv, and they block you coming in from Taba. Even if you don't want to be in Israel, if you just want to go and visit your friends and show support for the people of Palestine, this rogue regime can stop you. And this is all because of the fact that we want to use our constitutional right to say, you know what, Company B, you should not be investing in Israel because it's an apartheid state, it's a racist state, and it denies human rights to the people that actually live there.
Ty, I talked to you a week or two ago about your visit to Israel/Palestine. You told me the conditions in where you were just abominable. Talk about that real quick, if you would.
Yeah, we went. I've been in Gaza many times. I've been around near Jerusalem in Palestine many times, but I've never been to Hebron. We went to Hebron, and it is in lockdown conditions. It is most racist. It is real apartheid. If you want to know what it was like in apartheid South Africa, go to Hebron in Palestine. There's only 800 settlers in that city of 250,000 people that are absolutely controlling the movements, the daily movements in Hebron. There's these small little apartheid type settlements, illegal settlements, and they can walk down the street with full autos, but a Palestinian can't walk down the street without fear of the overwhelming amount of soldiers that are in that town, of being stopped, like my friend Isa Amra, that were stopped because the government, the Israeli soldiers, who tend to be 19, 20-year-old kids who don't really want to be there, they're from Tel Aviv, and they stop them and just harass them for no clear reason. It's just appalling, and people aren't... There are 1,800 shops that were shut down in Hebron along the main street. Main Street is completely shut down. It's an Israeli-only street now for 800 settlers. And it was shut down because an Israeli settler killed 29 Palestinians. They shut down Palestinians' ability to use their own main street with their shops. It's abhorrent. It's really sad. And then there's also the case of Ahed Tamimi, who we are going to do a protest for tomorrow in front of the convention center in D.C. Ahed was a 16-year-old girl who had her 17th birthday in an Israeli prison. They really use psychological and physical torture on this young girl. She was arrested for slapping an Israeli soldier in the face after he had shot her cousin, her 12-year-old cousin, in the eye. He lost part of his skull with a steel-coated rubber bullet. And they entered into her house, took their computers and their cameras and their cell phones, and she gets put in jail for slapping a soldier. It's really, really bad there.
Ty, we've got about a minute left. I wanted to ask you very quickly, what exactly are the AIPAC people hoping to accomplish with this convention?
Well, they're a big propaganda unit. I mean, they're there to tell people that that Israel is this poor country that's being oppressed by terrorism from all around, that it can't stand on its own, that it really needs American help, even though they have a higher standard of living in Israel than they do in Washington, D.C. And then the other aspect is they try and bring in young conservatives, especially young people of color. They'll always have a group of young people of color trying to bring them in, trying to convince them that Israel is this poor, oppressed country by these multitudes of Arabs, when actually they are in control of the entire area. It's really sad. And then obviously, every Monday after the convention, they go en masse to Congress and lobby. And they see every single representative and senator. And they don't know none of this waiting or anything like that.
We're going to have to leave it there. So Ty Berry is with Code Pink. They're having a demonstration tomorrow, Saturday, March 3rd, at the convention center where AIPAC is, for Ahed Tamimi. On Sunday, March 4th, there's going to be also a large demonstration starting at 12 noon at the White House at Lafayette Park, followed by a march to AIPAC. There will be people coming from all over the country, Palestinians and non-Palestinians, who say to the U.S. government, cut all the aid to Israel, which is financing and funding and making apartheid possible. But John, I think we're completely out of time.
Yeah, unfortunately, we are out of time. We were joined from Florida by Ty Berry. Ty is an anti-war activist and international solidarity organizer. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, is in trouble. Reports suggest that he's been meeting with the leaders of foreign countries not to discuss U.S. foreign policy, but to ask them for loans to prop up his family's real estate business. And the governments of China, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Mexico have all secretly talked about how to exploit Kushner's weaknesses. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Dave, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Dave, I want to talk about chaos in the White House in general, but I'd like to start with Jared Kushner. I have never seen somebody so embattled like Jared Kushner has been embattled probably since the Nixon administration, when Ehrlichman and Haldeman and John Dean and everybody else had indictments floating over them. It just seems like every day the New York Times and the Washington Post talk about things that Jared Kushner has done or has been accused of doing that are clearly crimes, or at the very least are not in the interests of the U.S. government. Go ahead. What do you think about this?
Yeah, well, this is we're in Teapot Dome scandal, you know, territory. I mean, this is an epically corrupt administration. It's all about the money, and you know, at least with Nixon, it was the corruption was in trying to achieve power and, you know, to crush enemies. But this is like really crass corruption of just going after money and using the power of office to enrich yourself. And it's rampant through the thing.
It's true. Joe Scarborough said this morning on MSNBC that the Trump administration has raised corruption to an art form, that they've normalized corruption to the point where we expect administration people to be corrupt, that we're not outraged by this.
But I have to just to jump in, and no defense of Donald Trump or Jared Kushner, all of this is politics, too. Because
sure,
in many ways, what Jared Kushner is doing in the pay for play, and when we look back at the role of the Clinton Foundation during the Obama years,
yeah.
I mean, all of these
which
people
also should have been prosecuted.
Yeah, all these people were donating to the Clinton Foundation, and then they were having access to the Obama administration or to the State Department. In the case of Kushner, some of the things that are coming out, and again, it would be interesting to know whether these reports about these four countries that Kushner had meetings with, or that they were talking about how Kushner was vulnerable because he needed money for 666. Fifth Avenue, his tower that's indebted to $1.2 billion in debt in New York and all that. That might have come from the NSA. That might be from NSA intercepts.
Yeah.
And then leaked to reporters.
That's right. The Washington Post broke the story, but they never said how they got the information. How do we know that these four different countries had these conversations behind closed doors about how to exploit Jared Kushner's weaknesses? It seems to me, and I'm speculating here, I don't have any inside information, but it seems to me that that had to have come from NSA, because it would be NSA that would be following these foreign leaders. And then somebody leaked the information to the Washington Post.
Yeah, the Post and the Times are using unnamed sources, but they're saying it with very categorical...
Yes, certainty.
With certainty, yeah. Here's some other things, Dave Lindorf. Mr. Kushner met multiple times with Joshua Harris. He was with the Apollo Global Management. In November, Mr. Harris' company, Apollo, made a loan of $184 million to Kushner Companies. In the spring of 2017, Jared Kushner met at the White House with Citigroup's chief executive Michael Corbett in March of the same season, 2017. Citigroup made a loan of $325 million to Kushner Companies and one of its partners. Now, Kushner has technically divested himself or is separated.
He says he has, yeah.
He's separated himself, but it's Kushner. It's the Kushner family. And it gives the appearance of impropriety.
Yes.
Because that's the threshold.
I mean, let's be clearer. When you divest yourself from your company and you're in an administration for 4 years or 8 years, you're not really divesting anything because your family is in control. You enrich the company, and then when you leave office, you go back to the company, and it's much, much bigger. So, I mean, it's a joke to say you divest, like with Trump, to say he's removed himself from the company.
Remember the divestments of Dick Cheney from Halliburton?
Right.
He was the chairperson of Halliburton. He became vice president. The Iraq invasion happened largely because Cheney was masterminding it, and then Halliburton got all the contracts for the oil fields in Iraq.
Right, and then he comes back, and it's like he's a shareholder, and he got enriched.
That's exactly right.
Let's talk more about the other parts of this, quote, chaos. I mean, there have been so many people who have left the Trump White House in the first year. I mean, it's way more than anything in recent history.
If you're talking just about senior staff, it's 18 now. It's 18 according to the Washington Post and The Intercept.
It's a TV reality show.
It really is.
And,
it's Big
and
Brother.
Trump is calling his own attorney general, Mr. Magoo. He called him an idiot.
An idiot, disgraceful, weak.
Yeah. And now it appears that H.R. McMaster, who took the place of Mike Flynn, who had to leave as national security advisor because he was charged with a crime and then pled guilty to lying, H.R. McMaster, at least in the media accounts, is also perhaps possibly leaving the White House sometime soon. Then you have Hope Hicks, the communications director, who was very, very close to Trump. She's either out or forced out this week.
Rod Portman last week for beating his first two wives.
Yeah, and then Dave Lindorf, we have on top of it all, Gary Cohn, who's the senior economic person, again, from Goldman Sachs, not exactly draining the swamp here, but he's Donald Trump's key economic advisor. Gary Cohn's a banker, a big banker with Goldman Sachs. He was against Trump imposing 25% tariffs on steel and 10% tariffs on aluminum. Perhaps he's on the way out. CNBC is reporting that should Gary Cohn resign, which may happen now that he's lost the economic argument on trade policy, CNBC is predicting that the stock market, which is very volatile, will go into free fall. And then you have Trump's tweets, Dave Lindorf. I want you to listen to Donald Trump's tweet from early this morning, Friday morning. Quote, when a country, USA, is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win. Example, when we are down $100 billion with a certain country and they get cute, don't trade anymore. We win big. It's easy. Okay, Trump wrote that at 5:50 this morning.
That's a sixth grader's view of international trade.
I'll say.
Then the stock market opened and immediately tumbled 400 points.
It's really mind-boggling. I was listening to a report last night on the radio. I can't remember. It was probably Money, that show Money on NPR, but where they were pointing out that the last time there was a trade war started in the United States by the U.S., the EU targeted its retaliation to swing states, and they're saying this is certainly what China will do and what Europe will do in this case, because what they do is they'll, like, for instance, Europe will target Harley Davidson in Ohio, and that's death for the Republicans, because that was their big praise for rebuilding a nearly bankrupt motorcycle company, iconic motorcycle company, and it'll tank the company. And they'll pick these places around the states where the industry is located that they want to target, and they'll crush it.
You know, China is the 11th largest seller of steel, foreign country, to the United States. Dave Lindorf, and the countries that are being hurt or will be hurt and will probably retaliate as a consequence to the trade tariffs, to the 25% steel, 10% aluminum, some people might think that's all about China. But actually, China doesn't sell a lot of steel to the United States. It's number 11. We're talking about Canada, South Korea, Germany. In other words, principal U.S. allies who are now the target of the Trump administration. Meanwhile, Wall Street obviously doesn't think it's a good idea. They're the neoliberal globalists. Gary Cohn doesn't think it's a good idea. The chaos that's coming, or that's coming every day, it seems to be, the genesis of it seems to be completely self-made from within the Trump administration. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, look at this. I mean, the really stupid thing is America doesn't make much steel. You know, all of our major steel foundries are shut. So we're talking mini mills and stuff. And it's very hard to ramp up steel production because the foundries are huge and the investments are huge. So if we have to pay more for imported steel, which is what we will be doing, because the people who need steel are still going to order it, it's going to raise the cost of construction for, you know, high-rise buildings. It's going to raise the cost for manufacturing anything we make with steel, including cars. Like Ford trucks, for example, are going to become more expensive. And so it's going to mean huge inflation in the country, a slowdown in the economy, you know, and loss of jobs. It's a total backfire. If we were making steel and we had foundries that were, you know, on maybe operating on one shift or something, or with some foundries shut down while others were still going, it might make sense because you could turn on some foundries, but we don't have any.
No, we don't even have any. I regret that we don't have the time to talk about some of these other issues, too, like the idea that both the Washington Post and the New York Times are reporting that more indictments are in the offing. So we're not done with this subject, not by a long shot.
No, and the Kushner thing is really interesting because this is just such epic corruption, and we haven't seen, I don't think, the end of that one. I mean, I think they're definitely going after Kushner because they want to have him squeal.
I'm just looking at The Intercept real quick to finish out, John. The real estate firm tied to the family of presidential son-in-law and top White House advisor Jared Kushner made a direct pitch to Qatar's Minister of Finance in April 2017 in an attempt to secure investment in a critically distressed asset in the company's portfolio, according to two sources. At the previously unreported meeting, Jared Kushner's father, Charles, he used to be in prison.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a convicted felon.
Who runs Kushner Companies, and Qatari finance minister discussed financing for Kushner's signature 666 Fifth Avenue property in New York City. Yeah, perhaps Jared Kushner's going to get indicted.
Yeah, this is going to become far more complicated than it's already become. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We were joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. Dave is an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. Steve, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
Steve, I'm looking at this announcement from the Department of Labor, and it makes me think Cesar Chavez, Eugene V. Debs, Arthur Goldberg, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, what a group, huh?
Samuel Gompers. So Ronald Reagan was named to the Department of Labor's Hall of Fame. Aside from membership in the Screen Actors Guild, why in the world would they do that when Ronald Reagan is also famous for busting the Air Traffic Controllers Union?
Well, there's no reason at all. Of course, he was anti-labor for most of his life. And even when he was in the Screen Actors Guild and the president, he wasn't really much of a labor guy. Of course, he was busy turning in his fellow actors. The headline and the action actually happened last August, but the induction into the Hall of Fame happened yesterday, which is why this headline resurfaced in social media. One thing that's kind of interesting is that there was a big protest outside the Hall of Fame, the Labor Department, I guess, yesterday, but not one outlet covered the protests.
It was organized by the trade union movement here in Washington, D.C., by the labor movement. Of course, fired 13,000 air traffic controllers, smashed the union, crushed the union, actually. And all the way back, I mean, Ronald Reagan was at one time a leader of the Screen Actors Guild, but he took it as part of it. He was the one who started naming names and getting rid of all the socialists and progressive actors.
He may have been a union leader, but he was a red baiter at the same time, naming names and pointing fingers.
He was no friend of labor. And the fact that this protest happened without coverage also tells you something about the media and their priorities. They don't want to cover anyone objecting to this outrageous action.
Yeah, why cover that when you can cover Russia, Russia, Russia? Which is another issue.
Well, speaking about Russia, Russia, and Russia, there's, of course, shockingly more Russia headlines, and we want to talk about those. But, Steve, this isn't a headline. This is a picture. I'm looking, John, you can see it.
Oh, this is Radio Land,
but it's a picture of Putin speaking at his press conference yesterday in Russia. It's a three-column-wide photo, and it looks like the detached head of Vladimir Putin staring down into the auditorium. The photographer had to lie on the floor to get this full shot of the looming, menacing picture of Vladimir Putin. It really looks like a complete Orwellian freak show.
That's the word. It's an Orwellian photograph. This is the front page of the New York Times. It's just a terrible, shocking photo.
Putin says he has, quote, invincible, close quote, nuclear missile. Anyway, let's talk about some of the other Russia headlines this week, Steve.
Well, let's start with a funny one, which was a Chris Saliza article. He's on CNN, and the headline reads, Russia, Russia, Russia. Donald Trump's early morning tweets reveal his ongoing obsession, which, considering the ongoing obsession of CNN and everyone else with Russia, 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 it's just a hysterical headline. I mean, yes, Donald Trump has had some things to say on the subject, too, but not even close to the amount that corporate media have had to say on the subject.
And the stuff is so bizarre. I mean, of course, Trump is obsessed with Russia. I mean, it's been dominating his first year in office. And as you said, Steve Pat, the Washington Post is obsessed with Russia. The New York Times is obsessed with Russia. CNN is obsessed with Russia. MSNBC really obsessed with Russia. Anyway, I want to talk about the Washington Post article. The headline you talked about, this is a really bizarre one about Belarusian sex worker. What is that?
Well, it just shows the standards of the media. The headline reads, it's laughable. The headline reads, Belarusian sex worker alleges Trump-Russia tie without proof. Right in the headline, they actually admit that this is a non-story. There's no proof of this story, but hell, they'll run it anyway. And again, this isn't the National Enquirer. This is the Washington Post.
Yeah, the headline actually reads this. A self-described sex expert says she will spill information on Trump and Russia to get out of Thai jail.
Well, you remember, democracy dies in darkness.
Another Russia-related, I'm afraid. This one, the headline isn't that remarkable. It says, U.S. show of force sends Russia a message in the Black Sea. But the first sentence of the article, which is what this is from CNN, and they tweeted out, news organizations send out tweets about their articles. And the tweet actually carried the first sentence of the article, which is this. The U.S. Navy is ramping up its presence in the Black Sea as part of a bid to counter Russia's increased presence there. And most of the people who tweeted this are on Twitter and posted it on Facebook, accompanied it with a map of the world showing exactly where the Black Sea was in comparison to the United States, several thousand miles away, and in comparison to Russia, several inches away.
The Russian fleet, the biggest part of the Russian Navy, is docked in the Black Sea. That would be in Crimea. It's like those headlines from a few months ago where Russia's war exercises were taking place right along NATO's borders. Now, there is no country named NATO, but what they mean is that Russia was carrying out military exercises along its own border, which happens to border areas where NATO is now carrying out military exercises. In other words, they're carrying out thousands of miles from home base military exercises at Russia's border. But no, Russia is carrying out military exercises, threatening exercises at NATO's border.
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing. We can do another Russian one, or we can move to North Korea, if you like. So take your pick.
Oh, let's go to North Korea.
Okay. Well, the headline, which is a big and a serious story, that's been dominating the news or has a certain presence in the news. Here's the BBC headline, North Korea providing materials for Syria chemical weapons. So that sounds pretty ominous. Except if you read the first sentence of the article, it says they could be used for chemical weapons. And what are they providing? They're providing acid-resistant tiles, valves, and pipes.
There you have it. That's the proof.
Yeah, this is totally reminiscent of the Iraq War. Anyone with a good memory remembers the aluminum tubes story, which was a big story pushed by our old friend Judith Miller in the New York Times.
That's right.
And which was one of the key things which got us into the Iraq War. And
well, let me say a word too about this misleading headline. Again, North Korea providing materials, this is in quote, providing materials for Syria chemical weapons. What North Korea may be providing would be what's called, John, dual-use technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during the Iraq sanctions regime that went on for 13 years that ended up killing, according to the UN, about 8,000 Iraqis per month, 5,000 children under the age of five, and the others mostly their grandparents, the very young and the very old, the vulnerable, those most in need of food and medicine. Those sanctions blocked dual-use technologies. So Iraq, for instance, could not import chlorine. And because we've heard a lot about chlorine weapons in Syria, Iraq could not import chlorine because they could be used as a component in a chemical weapon, a chlorine bomb. And so the entire nation was deprived of fundamentally essential chemicals during this entire 13-year period. So Iraq, which had a pristine water supply, drinking water supply before, had a terrible water supply. And most of the people who were dying from waterborne diseases. And then they didn't have medicines to treat easily treatable diseases like bloody diarrhea or something like that.
The bottom line there is that virtually everything can be deemed dual use. I remember having a conversation when I was at the CIA, sitting around a conference room table. The Iraqis had asked to import concrete from Jordan. Should we allow this concrete or not allow this concrete? And I thought to myself, well, how in the world can concrete be dual use? And the decision was made to deny the Iraqis this concrete because with concrete, they could build new roads and military vehicles could travel on those roads and they could invade Kuwait again.
Every possible use of anything for something else could be banned. So I'm glad you brought that up, Steve Pat. North Korea providing materials for Syria chemical weapons. It's like, as we said earlier in the week, John, it's like Satan sends bad weapons to the devil.
Right.
I'd like to go back to what you just said about Iraq, and this is important. If you go search on my blog for the Iraqi water supply, what you'll find is there was a report from the Department of Defense, I believe, which stated that the U.S. government knew exactly that there would be an epidemic caused by their refusal to allow chlorine importation into Iraq. They knew they were committing genocide. It was a planned genocide. They knew in advance what would happen, and they did it. So this is a very serious story.
Let's go to the last headline that we have time for. Trump says he would have rushed in unarmed to stop school shooter. Go ahead on that one.
Well, this is, of course, a laughable idea that he would have done it, that an overweight, out of shape, 71-year-old draft dodger would have rushed in unarmed to stop a school shooter.
Who has an aversion to the sight of blood, by the way, which he has talked about.
So everyone had a good laugh about that. I just wanted to come to the defense of Trump, actually not the defense of Trump, but to attack the media in the following way. All the headlines say exactly what you just said. He would have rushed in unarmed to stop the school shooter. But what he actually said was that he believed that he would do it, and you don't know until you test it. So he was somewhat equivocal.
Which is true.
And he also said he thought everyone in the room would also do it.
We're out of time, unfortunately. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.